Question: what is liberty? Hi, I'm Steve Donaldson, and this is Thinking Out Loud, an ongoing series of philosophical dialogues with everyday people. The question before us today is, what is liberty? Let's begin. We'll start as we usually do with introductions and first reactions. John?
Well, this is one expression of a popular theme in philosophy that also has to do with free will and various kinds of freedom, political freedom and personal freedom and that sort of thing.
Good. All right.
Erica Jensen. I don't know what else.
You can pass, or if you have a reaction or not, you'll wait to hear more, probably.
Okay. Yeah.
All right. And Rebecca?
My first reaction is to think of it in the inverse. What is not liberty?
Mm-hmm.
Especially in today's context when so many things have been taken away.
Okay.
Well, I'm Uriah, and being not too far from where William Penn was some years ago, I have to say, give me liberty or give me death.
Okay.
I'm Susan, and I'm thinking of that word as coming from a different era. I never hear it in conversation, and I think of 1700s in the United States or before that. So I think it's going to be an interesting word to talk about.
Okay.
I'm Derek, and I think that's a really good point about the way that the use of the word liberty has changed over time. My first thought was that it has to do a lot more with personal liberty, as in people saying I'm not at liberty to discuss or try or that kind of thing.
Well, and just to comment on that, I'm Billy. If you say I'm not at liberty, you could also translate I'm not free to talk about this. And just to add to what Rebecca said, I'd like to quote what Ralph Nader said here in Charlottesville a couple of weeks ago. He said, we still have many private rights, but not many public ones.
Hmm. Okay. Now, Steve Stokes in cyberspace, the cyber host, I'm going to turn it over to you to have your introduction and then cycle through the cyber guests. Go ahead, Stephen.
Hi, I'm Steve Stokes, and I'll not have any opening comments on liberty right now, and I'll take you to Luke in cyberspace for his opening remarks.
Hi, thanks, Stephen. I'm Luke from the UK. I'm very interested in the concept of liberty, in as much as personal liberty, and how that scales up into socio-political freedoms and liberty, and whether they're compatible and how they work together.
Okay, and next, what do we have?
Debbie, why don't you tell us what you think of liberty?
I'm Debbie. So I don't have any particular opening comments to make. I like the way Luke explained his opening comments, so I'm going to just have that comment for right now.
All right, Steve Whiteman.
Well, I'm just curious to see in what direction the conversation goes, because I'm not sure that we have a question yet. So I'm going to sort of hold off until I hear where we're going with this.
Okay, Dave, it's your question. What's on your mind?
And now that I've had some time to reflect, I remember what prompted me to ask this question. And it was really hearing or reading this term liberty appear in some political blogs that I participate in. And it got me thinking about the word, and my first, encounter with it was, I guess, as a child in reading about the revolution or learning about the revolution, as UJ said, give me liberty or give me death. And I think I would settle for something in between. And then I started thinking about, what are we being liberated from? And what are the things that oppress us that we feel that we need to strive for this pursuit of happiness or this notion of liberty? And can we ever achieve liberty? I mean, I suppose that it's a relative thing, that it's an ideal that we can never achieve nirvana. It's just a goal there that's for us to strive toward. And the things that I think that I find most oppressive don't come from government or society or or work. I feel that I have a lot of choice in my life, but what I feel that constrains my freedom is my conscience. It's the sense that I should do this and I shouldn't do that. And now I'm more curious to see how other people approach this notion of liberty and how they strive for freedom and to break free the shackles of convention.
All right, very good. Well, a lot of threads to start following here. I'm just going to voice what I picked up as one sort of major theme that we could explore or division, actually, that between, we're talking about private liberty and public liberty, the public sphere, the political, economic sphere, and then there's the personal, like David was talking about. But we could follow any one of a number of threads if anybody wants to follow up on that, John.
Well, there's artistic liberty, too, the liberty that expresses itself in artistic or intellectual creativity, creation.
Okay. That actually bridges a little bit, doesn't it? Because it comes from the personal, perhaps, but it's in a public sphere. Mm-hmm. So, Billy.
Would you call that freedom of speech?
Freedom of speech is
freedom of speech is part of it, definitely.
Speech in a broad way.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Rebecca.
I would think sort of going back to the founding fathers concept of but also, I don't know what ethic we're all coming from, but I heard a sort of a nirvana freedom, and I don't perceive anyone characterize freedom as to do anything you want. We sort of have the Judeo-Christian limits around us. You know, you're not free to kill someone, but you ought to be free to wear your hair in a manner that isn't going to trigger TSA, for example.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a little concerned about the idea that we're talking about any and all freedom.
Okay. I see Steve Stokes, you have your hand up. Let's cycle through cyberspace a little bit. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, I was wondering if maybe we could map this out. I mean, not free to do any and everything. I mean, what would that would be like absolute freedom? So Rebecca was just saying that we don't ever have any way to approach absolute freedom. Is that right, Rebecca?
That's right. I don't, we have liberties, but those are liberties that our society has put certain bounds on it. Even in the artistic expression, you know, you can't slander and libel people sort of thing. So we have some bounds that as a society we have agreed they're reasonable bounds, and what concerns me most about liberty is those bounds as a society we are not agreeing to constricting them, they are being constricted for us.
Let me get Billy in here.
Well, just in the terms of liberty again, our Constitution was created because, as Madison said, if men were angels we'd have no reason for government. So we are accepting that men are not angels, and there are constraints upon certain of our actions that will be harmful to others.
Okay, so we're talking kind of in a social political sphere here right now. I see David has his hand up. Let me let David in here. Go ahead.
Well, I just have a question. It was Robinson Crusoe free? Or Tom Hanks in Castaway, if you don't remember Robinson Crusoe.
What would you say, David?
I don't know. I mean, in one sense, he's trapped on an island and isolated from other humans. But you know, in another sense, he's free from all convention.
Now, it's interesting.
So he's liberated in one sense, but he's not liberated in another sense. And I'm just curious. It was Debbie's comments that sparked that question.
Well, perhaps we might want to look at, perhaps there's a difference between the use of the word freedom and the use of the word liberty. I'm picking up that we're using liberty when we're talking about a political system, and then when we're talking about something like being free to do something on an island, we use the word freedom instead of liberty. So there may be really talking about two different things here. Let me get. I see.
Yeah, but I think there's synonyms with overlapping mean.
Okay, Steve Stokes.
Yeah, I like the castaway scenario because it would seem as if that gives us, some sort of basis to really talk about this subject with meaning. I mean, your castaway still has to find food and still has to provide shelter for themselves, and so those animal needs or what binds us up as living beings that require us to do certain things and therefore restrict our liberty are still in play even if you're all alone on a desert island. But the social boundaries and restraints are totally removed, almost.
Right.
I would imagine that a castaway might still wear clothing because it's so programmed in their mind since they were babies that they have to have covering on their body that they might be inhibited to run around naked even though they're the only person on the island. And that would be a lack of liberty.
That's an interesting way of combining the two realms that we were talking about, the external social political and what David early on was talking about, like conscience and so forth, and how we can internalize the social. So it actually, what we think is private is actually not all that separate from our political. Let me quickly get Luke in, and then we'll cycle through in the local sphere again. Luke, go ahead.
Thank you. Yeah, some great points brought up. I suppose what sparked me off was the comment about the idea of the founding fathers in the Constitution of the United States, which I find fascinating.
That's a sore subject.
I find the history of the Americas particularly fascinating. Well, one of the things that was brought up with the Constitution was I think one of the ladies mentioned that it was, for example, a quote from one of the founding fathers was that if men were perfect or something, we wouldn't need governance. But I would equally pose the question back: if men aren't perfect inherently, or a good majority of them, then how the problems are then simply exacerbated, perhaps by government. In many cases, you might think it's worse, for example, by having a coercive rulership. Like you've given a monopoly on that power, so the ultimate access to that person. But I don't want to get too much into that. The idea was really that it brought up interesting questions for me between the idea of freedom and liberty and whether there are some concessions to be made between immediate personal freedom and liberty and how that affects others around you. So if I have, the way I started to think about it was perhaps if I'm in a jail cell, for example, I have certain freedom within the cell. I wouldn't say I'm a free human being, but I certainly say perhaps if people were put there unjustly, it would be violating my liberty. But perhaps freedom's more contextual in that sense. It's more sort of abstract, like the idea of free will and absolute freedom and freedom to dance, this kind of thing. Whereas liberty definitely has a more sort of socio-political connotation to it.
All right, let me get some local flesh in here. Let me go with John, and then Eugene next. Go ahead, John.
I've heard of freedom defined as the acceptance of necessity, and that may be why Tom Hanks or Robinson Crusoe experienced freedom on his little island, because the necessities were so clear. It was clear what was necessary and what was not.
Okay.
But in ordinary society, sometimes it's hard to tell what's necessary and what's merely customary.
Mm-hmm.
So you're always... You're never quite sure whether you're free or not.
Okay, good. And UJ, you're next.
Well, two psychologists sort of come to mind. One was Skinner, B.F. Skinner, who wrote the book on Beyond Freedom and Dignity. And the other one is Eric Fromm, who, of course, emphasized that no one is free unless that intellectual, political, and economic freedom, and that either one of these is missing. You are not free. Now, I see a distinction between liberty and freedom. Liberty, to me, is like a process of getting freedom. And if you're free, you don't need no liberty. You know, you've already achieved it. However, the catch in that is that you're not going to be free. There is no such thing as freedom because that is predeterminism. And freedom on that side of the coin would mean that you have certain parts of your life, most of it, predetermined. And as Skinner would say, so you can take credit for what you do along that line. The other part of it is, it's like when you think you got freedom, you become more or less a tyrant. And to the extent you become a tyrant, like we see in many instances, you actually become a victim of your own freedom and of your own power.
All right. Billy, you had your hand up.
Two things. What you just said. What is Lloyd Acton's saying? All power corrupts. Total power corrupts totally.
Yeah, absolute power corrupts absolutely.
Yes.
Yeah.
Paraphrase.
Yeah.
And then the other, you mentioned Eric Fromm, and I'm thinking of the really classic book that he wrote with the title "Escape from Freedom,"
mm-hmm.
about authoritarian societies where people are never taught to freely choose. And when they are put in a situation where they can freely choose, and this goes back to existentialism, which is back there now, you're in a terrible dilemma. And many people at that point, where if they're not raised to think independently, want someone to tell them what to do. That's the other side of it.
Okay, I'm going to get some cyber guests back in here, and then we'll come back. I think Debbie Martin, you were next. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, I kind of lost a little bit of what I wanted to say, but it was along the lines of, I think, what Steve Stokes was saying, and just that I find it hard to compare, the liberty or freedom of a castaway as compared to somebody living in a, regular society. I mean, when you're living there by yourself, you are pretty much free to do and whatever you want to do, whether it's wearing clothes or not wearing clothes, you've got to meet your basic needs, but I don't see where you'd really have any freedom issues because you're not at least in a social sense, you're not relating to anybody, so you're free to sit, stay or do whatever you want. So it was kind of an unusual comparison to me. I don't see how you can compare that.
All right. Let me get Steve Stokes in here. Steve?
Yeah. I wanted to kind of address the economics of liberty. It seems like liberty is a virtual sort of thing, or the loss of liberty is a virtual thing. Legislatures can write a law, say like the law that if you're a certain race, you have to sit in a certain position on the public transportation. The so-called blacks to the back of the bus laws. So those laws existed, but did they really curtail anybody's liberty? Because in an act of social defiance, blacks sat in front of the bus. So there wasn't like any sort of magic. Nothing happens when one set of humans says, you're not free to do this. You physically are still able to do even what they said, you can't do. So it's like we give up our liberties when we acknowledge these artificial walls that are put up, and it's our tacit agreement to live within those walls that actually make them exist. And so any lack of liberty in that social construct is only there in so much as we go along with it.
Well, you brought up two things I want to emphasize here. One is the idea of structure or construct, and also your example of the very words we use to describe what you were referring to is the fight for civil liberties, and that's putting liberty and civil together, and it might be instructive for us to think about that phrase and what it means, and how it's different from what you were referring to as freedom. The difference between you may be free but not have a civil liberty, for example. Let me leave it at that, and let's see, kind of follow who was next in line here. David Rood, I think. David?
Okay, I was just thinking about liberation, you know, liberty, liberation. And when the Soviet Union dissolved and Yugoslavia was liberated, and when Iraq was invaded by the United States and quote unquote liberated, it did not result in anybody feeling any sense of liberty, I don't think. I mean, the Balkans endured several years of very, very vicious fighting amongst themselves, and sectarian violence is well known in Iraq to all of us here. And it strikes me that there's a certain irony in that when we liberate from something, we tend to open up a can of worms that that presents a whole different set of questions that we have to deal with once we're liberated. And I'll give you another example. Once the robber barons were kind of reined back by the Teddy Roosevelt and the trust busters, it opened up a lot of opportunities for people who had been kind of screwed by the robber barons and these big trusts, and they didn't know what to do. They had too many. There were the socialists dragging them in one direction, and then Democrats and Republicans dragging them in another direction, and they really did not coalesce to do anything constructive beyond that point. And then the World War I, and then the 20s and the Great Depression, and then it all became sort of diffused. And so my question is liberation always a good thing?
All right, good question. Let me cycle through. Billy, you're
well, ahead. I wanted to go back to the word freedom again and what Steve was saying about it. I think we have a freedom rider in this room, don't we? Weren't you a freedom rider, UJ?
Some think so.
Okay. Would you say that you were?
A freedom what?
Rider.
Oh, I've been involved in fighting for freedom.
Yeah. Okay. Actively involved in that. And I would just say that Rosa Parks, when she decided not to sit on the back of the bus, paid a price.
Right.
It wasn't free.
Yeah. Well, that gets back. I think Luke, I'm going to call on Luke next, but Luke mentioned earlier the situation of being in jail. And in one sense, you can still be free to express yourself, but there's a very real sense in which your liberty, your civil liberty, has been curtailed drastically. So I think we are, just in how we're using the words, we tend to use liberty when we're talking about what degree of oppression or suppression that we're experiencing in a political, social context. And freedom is more of a sort of whether you can actually, what you can physically, do, or, if you're not. But let me get Luke in. Luke's next from UK. Go ahead, Luke.
Thank you. One of the problems, or perhaps not problems, but dichotomies that I see is between what I call a sort of bottom-up approach versus a sort of top-down approach. And what I mean by that is, what strikes me is how it's possible to look at the real the real battles throughout all of history, the real struggles of mankind. I've often seen them as really, as always, the fight between the liberty or civil liberties, rights, whatever, of the individual against the so-called rights of the quote society or the collective in some fashion. Often fight for individual freedoms against tyrannical oppression, and how a lot of these things, a lot of events which are horribly repressive to many individuals, are often justified through the words, for example, liberate or whatever, we're going to liberate a society or a nation. And it kind of skews the perspective, in my view, somewhat, because you have this idea of, quote, this society, which is almost like a separate entity of it, with its own volition and so on. But really, it's not. It should be a bottom-up process where the society is composed of individuals and so on, and only individuals are sort of real beings, and the individuals within a society all agree and all disagree, for example, and have different ideas about the way society should go. So I think a lot of the problem in the past, especially wars and disagreements on the political social scales, have often been justified through things called the so-called good of society, where in truth society in a certain context doesn't really exist to some degree. So I find that sort of abuse of the language is very interesting. But there is this sort of like the Gandhi thing where he kind of said. Change must start from yourself. You must be the change that you want to see in the world. I think a lot of that is related to this freedom, this liberty. That really, if I was to talk about power structures and dissolution of power structures throughout history, where there's been corruption and so on, and often it's very important to start with yourself. If there is, for example, corruption or a lack of personal liberty in your own life, it can start with your own families, with power structures within parents, families and so on, and then extend and perhaps into socio-political arena. But the idea is they shouldn't be incompatible, but I think a lot of what we learn and take for granted, i.e. freedom for societies and so on, is really learnt from when we're very young, when perhaps we have these structures and things taught to us when we're young, and we sort of extend that onto in a social context.
Very good. Yes.
Good and bad. Yeah.
A lot of meat there. At some point, I think there was a whole topic. One of my favorite topics at some point I'd like to address is this concept of society as being an organism in and of itself. But that's a whole separate question. But your points are well taken as far as how we see liberty being bottom up or top down and on this conflict and so forth. Let me get Steve Whiteman in here. Go ahead, Steve.
Well, I wanted to go back to what Steve Stokes said. I have a feeling that that I didn't fully understand him, because when you say that you sit in the back of the bus as a choice rather than sitting in the front of the bus, that doesn't quite ring true to me, because if you choose to sit in the front of the bus and there is a law against it, then you're going to be jailed. And surely if there's a situation where if you make choice A, everything's fine, and you make choice B and you go to jail, that can't be said to be free to make A or B as a choice, I don't think. If they have, if one of them has a very, nasty consequence. So I'm sure Steve had some, good point he was making there, but I think I didn't understand it, so I'd be interested to hear him respond.
Well, because we have so many other people waiting in line, let me take a quick shot at paraphrasing what I think Steve was getting at, and that's kind of what we were talking about, the distinction between freedom and liberty, whereas you may be physically unconstrained to take action, even though the political structure is denying you to do it without, you can't do it without getting having political consequences, for instance, going to jail. But let me Steve Whiteman, if you have more to say, go ahead. Otherwise, I'm going to need to move on to Debbie. Did you want to say more, Steve Whiteman? You have the floor.
I just wanted to hear what Steve had to say.
Okay. Well, to be fair, we need to keep moving. Debbie, you're next.
Yes. Steve Whiteman said exactly the same thing that I was going to say, so I can ask.
Okay. Let me get Billy in here.
Well, I want to jump over to Luke and just to comment on what he was talking about of a group or a nation and so forth. And the title of a book that I'm quite fond of called The Myth of the State.
The Myth of the State.
The Myth of the State.
Okay.
And then I would like to tell you a very short little story about a four-year-old who had learned the Pledge of Allegiance. And the four-year-old said, I pledge allegiance to the United States of America and to the what? What's the next one?
To the Republic
for which it stands. And then this very prescient little four-year-old said, one nation, invisible, with liberty and justice for all.
There you go. John, did you have your hand up?
Oh, yes, I was thinking.
You know what? Everyone's waking up.
There's a question of whether we have economic freedom.
Economic, okay.
Or whether we are simply driven by a sort of economic force or entity that acts through us. We are the limbs of a large economic organism.
Uh-huh.
So it seems to me you could imagine it either way.
Okay. UJ.
Well, it seems to me, Steve, that economic freedom really has to do with meeting primarily your maintenance needs. We had a question on the board about the things between wants and needs. And I think that economics refer primarily and basically to our needs. Now, beyond that, we can be gluttonous, we can, you know, waste and extravagance and all these things. But when a person is not able, for example, to have food, then all the other freedoms go down the drain, you see. And so economic freedom, as Eric Fromm said, becomes very important, that aspect, if you're going to be free, you see. Now, I happen to feel, of course, that a lot of our freedom had to do with attitudes and also constraints. And how much are we constrained, and what is our ability to oppose those constraints, to do anything about them? You see, now there are times that we can do something about the constraints, but there are other times the powers are too overwhelming, and it literally may be in our demise to even resist those constraints. So the attitude, though, comes in very important, because a lot of people are free, at least in terms of what we call freedom. I have to agree with Balmer, who said, you understand, beyond freedom and dignity. But I think that we are often, many people are free and don't know it. And the other part of it is, many people simply do not use the freedom they have. They talk about freedom, but they don't use the freedom they have. Like some people tell me they're against the Iraq war. But I said, what are you doing about it? You're free to do something, aren't you? You could raise, you could get in front of the bus and stop the bus. You could put a flag up and burn the flag. You could do many things to bring attention. And some people do. But others, it's fear. So fear is the great barrier, obstacle to being free.
Okay. Derek.
UJ just allowed me to say I only have one thing to say, because the other thing I wanted to get into was fear as the antithesis of freedom. And I think that to build on that a little bit, what I see happening, especially in modern times, is that fear is used, in other words, the fear of losing freedom is used to justify invasion, to justify liberation, to justify action. And then, in fact, that action feeds the fear even further, and we're in this vicious cycle. I wanted to share a personal experience of having been in the military, and in the Navy, we refer to time off as liberty. Liberty call is when you're allowed to leave the ship. And I have never had less liberty than when I was fighting for freedom in the Persian Gulf. We literally were not given liberty for the length of the Gulf War. And I've never forgotten that realization or that irony that, in fact, those fighting for freedom have the least amount of freedom. And the other thing I wanted to respond to, though, in terms of the... I would argue that freedom or liberty as a noun is a myth, whereas our actions are something that either demonstrate freedom or a lack of freedom. And so I think that I'd be interested in people's thoughts about this idea of freedom or this idea of liberty as something that's used to justify action, as opposed to the actions we take, like perhaps protesting a war in demonstration of freedom versus talking about freedom as a commodity that can be held.
Okay. Well, what comes up for me is another whole dimension that is critical here, that is the psychological realm. Using fear or using shackles that are not made out of iron, but they're just as strong and can keep people from doing things they otherwise might want to do. So the concept of a psychological or an entity or controlling in ways that are more sophisticated than in the feudal days when the kings would send out their, you know, and drag you off and chop your head off.
Like self-censorship.
Self-censorship, exactly. Now, I do have some people who have been waiting patiently. Steve Stokes, you're next in line in cyberspace. Go ahead.
I wanted to wonder out loud with the group as to whether wild animals are seen as having total liberty because they're wild animals, or whether it doesn't make any sense to talk in terms of a grizzly bear having liberty or not. My thinking is, I'm going back to Proto Man, when we're walking around in little family units hunting and gathering as we like. It seems like at that point in time, man was most at liberty, and probably when we invented language was the beginning of the end of our total liberty, because language in many ways restricts just the way you think, and therefore it's binding and controlling. And then as we formed bigger societies, as we went from little family units to tribes, that required that more of the individual's behavior was supplanted for the common good. And this is the process of the erosion of liberty.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where I'm thinking. And if people can jump in and try to join best they can.
Well, we got David. David is next. David, you go ahead. Yeah. David?
Yeah, I think it was Luke that brought up the fear factor. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you. And Derek was talking about
Hello?
The fear.
Yeah, lovely.
Am I being heard?
Yes, we hear you.
Okay. The notion that fear is the antithesis of liberty is an interesting concept to me, because I have a friend who is angry at the world. She is depressed, and she assigns all of the reasons that she's angry and depressed and frustrated about her life to external forces, when in fact, what I and several of my professional friends are well aware of is that, what is really bothering her is locked up inside of her, either in hormonal, imbalance or psychological baggage, but she can't see that. Or if she does see it, she doesn't want to take that leap outside of herself to liberate herself. And, you know, in the same way that we're psychologically trapped by our fears, I think that we, on a sociological level, I think we do the same thing. I think it was John Stuart Mill that said that he was more afraid of his neighbor than his government, because, you know, he could always run and hide from his government, but you can't run and hide from your neighbors. And we are sort of trapped in this society that has expectations of us. We internalize those expectations, and then we trap ourselves in this fear prison that we create.
All right.
Just thinking out loud.
Yes, very good, very good. Now, Erica's been waiting a long time. Let's get Erica in here.
Well, some of what I wanted to say goes back to earlier things, but I tend to think of freedom as only being within the social realm, that it's really not a term you can apply at all to either animals or to someone on a desert island, that it doesn't have any meaning there, that it only has meaning within society, and it only has meaning when you have the opposite of freedom, when you have your own internal fear or a law or some external physical force. And that's pretty much all.
Mm-hmm. So there's a relationship that fear of freedom from what, or of liberty from what, or free to, if there was no constraints, if there was no force constraining, then the words wouldn't have any meaning.
Yeah, and also I think the idea that if you, I kind of view freedom as you only have it once you have all your physical needs met. So I feel like someone on a desert island, you're going to be constantly looking after all of your needs. When are you going to feel free to do anything? When are you going to, you know, write a novel, paint a painting? You're never going to do that because you're always going to be thinking about survival.
Okay.
So it's only with society, which sets up ways for you to take care of all your needs, that you do have the opportunity to follow them. Though I agree that often most people don't even pursue their freedom. They don't know what to do with it.
Mm-hmm. So here we have elaboration, a little bit of a flip side of what was alluded to by several of you earlier, that society is what can interfere with liberty and constrict your freedom and so forth. What Erica was saying was that that society can also be a source to provide you with more liberty and freedom that you might have had otherwise, because it can provide you, because it can take care, provide you with a way to take care of your needs, your basic needs, so that your higher needs then can be addressed. Let me get UJ in here.
This may be a little eschatological, but we are free to die. And that is the ultimate freedom. And many times we find that liberation and that freedom that we really aspire to at death. In other words, we are free from the responsibility that people do and don't want. Jobs people go to and don't like. Walls people fight, you understand me, don't want to go in. So just all of these kinds of things that got us involved in ways we don't want to be involved in. In immortality, we gain that complete, absolute freedom.
That's interesting, some concepts that you raised, the idea of obligation, responsibility, duty. These are things that, in a social setting, can make us feel like we don't have the freedom we want, because, you know, I got to go to work, or I have this obligation to meet, or so forth. Derek,
I was just going to comment about we have laws that actually say we are not free to die, and I think it's something that would be an interesting thing to look at what level it is death. I believe that death is freeing, but I don't believe that we all feel free to die at any time.
But you will die.
Oh, absolutely. Sure. Will be a release, in a sense. But I feel that I have that choice to make. I just watched a woman of 79 years who wanted to die and was not allowed to die by the government, by the state, by the, and by members of her family. So I do wonder if we have that freedom.
Yeah, it's interesting. Also, I'm not sure if UJ, you were meaning
well,
that freedom in the sense of that would be something you can always choose, or is that something that's going to happen to you?
Not necessarily something you can choose, but you do choose it. You even chose to be born, and you chose your parents. So everything that happens to you was by choice.
I think that's a very different conversation than what we're
even,
having.
And even when you have an accident, you chose it, because you had not been in that particular place. If you chose to go there, it wouldn't have happened.
Yeah, that's on another level there.
Metaphysically, maybe.
Let me get, who did you, okay, well then Steve Stokes, I got you next here. Go ahead.
Yeah, I guess this comment follows Erica's. And with the extreme rise in gas prices and on the heels of rising gas prices, food prices, you know, I feel like my liberties are all wrapped up with my dependence on oil and my dependence on eating. That these things are really impinging on, you know, the whole concept that liberty that we really understand is liberty that's removed from us. So if higher prices in gas means that I've got to work more hours in the day just to survive, then liberties are eroding away in that manner.
Okay. John?
Or being stolen from us. That's what really rankles. Yes, Erica said that freedom doesn't mean anything in connection with animals. But I think it does. For example, an animal that's being kept in a small cage is obviously less free than one that's allowed a free-range chicken, for example, much more free than one that's being kept in a small cage. But the balance of nature means that too much freedom for any one species is a bad thing, because if there are no little birds, there are no sparrows, then the locusts take over. So there can't be too much freedom for anyone special. There has to be a balance.
So there's a structure there, too, mm-hmm. even though we don't necessarily think of it in those terms. But in society, I like what Erica was saying, that in society, it's the very structure, when it's balanced, that provides us with more liberties than we might otherwise have mm-hmm. if we had to constantly scramble to just stay alive. But on the other hand, if it's out of balance, it could deprive us of freedom. So there is this
who is society? We have to ask that too.
Yeah.
Who is society?
Well, that's what Luke was raising that question. Billy, let me
Well, on that point, I just wanted to say that many people think that our Constitution was created with a balance of power.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like to go back to what Steve said. We're talking about a kind of, and John had brought up too, we're talking about a kind of economic determinism, aren't we? Well, in terms of gas prices and so forth. And many mm-hmm. people are constrained by this.
Right. David, you're next.
Yeah, I'm just trying to put this into one, you know, kind of distill this into one question, and let me pose this. Can liberty be construed as the freedom to make a choice between undesired options?
I don't
understand.
Can you explain?
Well, let me say it again. Is liberty the freedom to make choices between undesired options?
Well,
do you mean,
is it still liberty?
Let me give you an example. Okay, now the Iraqis were liberated from Saddam Hussein. They were free to either, you know, support a unified government or support their sectarian leaders or their militias or one of the many warlords or sheiks. No one in that position, they were also happy to have Saddam gone, or most of them, and they were presented with these new options, but none of them looked very good. And I think that, you know, that's sort of the extreme, And I think that we're, all of us are, once we are liberated from something, we're faced with these an array of options, none of which seem to be all that great, you know, once we attain this level of freedom or liberty.
Well, certainly you can find examples and come up with examples where being free from oppression might leave you with still not very good choices, but you can also have examples where just the opposite is true. I'm not sure if the
let me give you another example. You go through 4 years of college, you graduate, and then you have to face life. That's what I'm talking about.
And some people find that terribly liberating, and some people might find that terribly frightening. So I'm not sure.
Exactly.
I'm not sure if you can say that because some people are frightened by that, that they haven't been liberated from what came before.
But no, I'm not saying that at all. They are liberated, but you know, liberation. You know, we tend to think that once we're liberated, we have you know, found our happiness, and that's only the beginning of the pursuit, is what I'm saying.
Perhaps. Let me get Rebecca in yet.
I tend to think of liberties as, I said it's sort of a Judeo-Christian framework within which we have, as a society, more or less collectively agreed to live. Sometimes those liberties are framed by constitution, by law, but supposedly it's a collective decision. We then have freedom, certain freedom, not absolute freedom, within that agreed upon framework of liberty. You can choose to go get a job after college, or you can choose to not get a job. You have the freedom. Okay? But I'm actually still a little bit stuck on the whole gas discussion, because I think that trivializes the concept of freedom. Every society has some kind of constraints based on the distribution of wealth, based on the distribution of power. And I think that is what defines liberty, or those distributions, and whether the people who have more of everything impose their absolute will on everyone else, thereby taking away, through the definition and constriction of liberties, taking away freedom.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me mention another angle that might tie in with what we've been saying, and that is the concept. I think UJ's hit on it a little bit. The concept of participating in determining your own direction. The idea of having a say in what's going to happen to you. It doesn't mean that it should be, or necessarily would be easy, or that, you know, let's say the liberty or the freedom to choose a career path. You might want to become a farmer, or you might want to become a lawyer, or you might want to become a bus driver, and let's say you choose to become a farmer. Doesn't mean that's going to be easy. So the fact that it's not easy doesn't mean that you didn't get your liberty, or the liberty is a bad thing, or because somebody else might have chosen another career and had easy time of it. So I think that David, I guess I'm addressing your point here, having liberty, I think your point is that that's not a guarantee for happiness, but I'm not sure anybody was saying that it was. Did you want to respond to that?
Well, I think that it's a popular notion that it is.
Ah, okay.
That liberty is the end of the road, and what I'm saying, it's only the beginning.
Okay. Well, let me get Steve Stokes in. I see he's been waiting. Go ahead, Steve.
I guess I got two things. One thing is my cool, nifty Lack of Liberty experiment. It's a mental experiment. But imagine, if you would, that you for the day, agree to only do what someone else commands you to do, that you totally surrender all liberty over to a third party, and this person is going to tell you, you know, when to lift your right arm and when to walk forward, and just like you're their little automaton, and you can only do what you're explicitly told, and just wonder how many minutes you would last under total control of somebody else before you reach the breaking point and had to say the safe word to get out of this arrangement.
10 weeks of boot camp.
No, I mean, boot camp isn't even that constraining. I mean, you
have
still,
you been to boot
I mean,
camp?
Yeah, I know.
Pretty
boot
close.
Camp is pretty close, but not exactly what I'm describing. This total, complete, only what somebody else tells you to do, you do. Not giving you just vague directions, and you figure out the spaces in between. I mean, every single thing, you don't do it unless you're told. I mean, this
it's
is
more like marriage in boot camp.
There you go.
So, Steve, we get your point that would be an awful situation, and what do you want to say about that? I don't think anybody would want
I
that.
I want to say that the gas situation doesn't trivialize topic of liberty. It actually underscores it and says this is what's really at issue is what do you get to do versus what do you have to do? I mean, actually, we're talking about needs versus wants in a disguised manner.
Mm-hmm. That tends to happen in these discussions. We get all topics eventually into the whatever topic we choose. That's why it's not too concerning of which topic we choose. We tend to get into it. But I think
I want to summarize.
Go ahead.
I think we're getting close to the end. But control is always an illusion. And liberty is a doubly so, an illusion.
Okay, Derek might have had a response to that.
Something I can finally agree with. I've been holding back a little bit. I'm more on the idea that I think that, I don't know if trivializing was the right word in terms of saying it, but I had trouble fully buying your argument about oil as someone who's chosen to live without a car. As someone who made a conscious choice several years ago not to be in that game. And so I would argue that, again, that is actually a good example of where we do have self-determination, where we can exercise our freedoms. People are free in this country not to drive, not to eat food that's raised with petroleum fertilizer and such. And the other thing that I wanted to respond to is the idea that part of what the conclusion that I'm drawing is that it leads to another question, I guess, which is, do freedoms matter if we're not exercising them? In other words, all the freedoms that are being talked about by leaders or by pop stars or whatever else, do those freedoms matter if they're not freedoms that we're exercising in our daily lives? And I would argue that many of those freedoms don't matter, and they become dangerous. The freedoms that don't matter are the ones that will become the most dangerous potentially, because anyone can use them to whatever end they wish.
All right. I'm going to get we're just about out of time, and I see Luke has his hand up. I'm going to let you in here and have the last word, so go ahead, Luke from the UK.
Oh, thank you. I kind of feel like the pressure's on now. on a high note. I guess the running theme throughout this that I took for it from it were the differences between the words sort of liberty and freedom. And I sort of had the idea that we were talking about liberty in more a social context. So how do the freedoms of one man or a woman violate potentially the freedoms or liberty of others? So it has a kind of social connotation. So that's interesting. So when we're talking about liberty, I just started to wonder, especially I think Steve even mentioned, Stephen Stokes made a comment that, you know, liberty is perhaps always relative. And that's certainly interesting because, you know, I wonder is it possible to define a sort of universal set of ethics or morality, and is that the goal of liberty? You know, to maximise everybody's freedom in a social context, Can we define a set of universal principles, for example? What one that comes to mind is something like the non-aggression principle, for example, which says you cannot initiate force against others. But then, of course, it brings up the question of, well, you know, who adjudicates that principle? And someone adjudicating that principle, do they have the right to violate the principle? And it's kind of like who watches the watchers kind of thing. So you get into all sorts of tricky areas. But that's what I sort of left with, I think. Is there a universal set of preferred ethics or behaviours or morality that we can sort of take from this and apply to society? I'm not sure, but it's given me something to think about for sure.
Very good, very good. And in fact, as so often happens, we have more questions to chew on, and they're ripe for further discussion in episodes in the future. I like in particular this idea that this note of to what end? To what end do we want these freedoms or need these freedoms or liberty? What's the ultimate goal? And related to that is the idea of who or what or how to self-govern as a collective. These are ripe for future discussion, but for now I think we have to end it. We've done our hour, and so that's all the time we have for today. Thank you very much, participants, for sharing your thoughts, and thank you, listeners, for tuning in. For more information about this show and how you, the listener, can participate on the show, visit our website at www.citizenphilosopher.com. Until next time, this is Steve Donaldson wishing you all the joys of philosophical reflection, and remember, thinking is a good thing. Everyone has a right to enjoy it.
Freedom. There you go.
But are we at liberty to enjoy it?
There you go.